we'll wrap. I guess wrap in the sense that we're going to WRAP. It's my responsibilities for this visit at Holy. At least Kathy knows how hungry I am for news from back home. The postmistress, or mistress of the post, or whatever, mistress of mail, or whatever Kathy's called. I still got to hang up with definitions. I ain't going to call his name. Wally helped me an awful lot with words and concepts and phrases. I still got that hang up. All right? And he keeps saying, don't call my name so much, so I'm not going to call his name. I'm going to honor that simple request from one of the saints of the village. But anyway, I have to read Herb Cain. For those of you who are not familiar with Herb Cain, he writes in the tradition of Mark Twain, not quite as biting in his satire, but almost as the late Mark Twain. Mark Twain, too, wrote for the San Francisco Chronicle. And I remember picking up one of the dark, dusty copies of the Chronicle and reading stuff that Mark Twain had written in his book. Well, anyway, Mark Twain, too, asked certain questions about man. And if any of you saw the CBS special, Mark Twain, Hal Holbrook plays the part. And if they should ever bring it to Broadway or off-Broadway and you're in that vicinity, then see it, because the message comes through loud and clear. Mark Twain asked, could it not be that the deity created man because he was disappointed with the monkey? Well, Herb Cain continues to ask questions like this, along with another columnist who writes for the Chronicle, Art Hoppe. Art Hoppe, at least, is not a stranger to students at PLU, because his column also appears in your... there's some PLU students. Somebody named the newspaper for me here. The Mooring Mast. The Mooring Mast. Art Hoppe is reprinted in The Mooring Mast. However, certain things that Hoppe does are censored, and they are not... they're not in the PLU newspaper. We shall see whether or not this little thing that Hoppe just did in the it's the August 20th edition of the San Francisco Chronicle. I was sharing it with Fred and Avis, and I thought I'd share it with you because it sort of puts into a kind of play some of the things that I've been seeing since I've been here over the past 2.5-3 weeks. The scene is the real estate office. The landlord, humming a little tune, is happily whipping up another galaxy to place in the firmament as one of his agents, Mr. Gabriel, enters hesitantly. The landlord speaks. And now if I take 1,000,000 parsecs of stardust and 1,000,000,000 bushels of moon glow, stir thoroughly, and Gabriel interrupts. Excuse me, sir, but you did ask that I interrupt you with any reports from Earth. The landlord. Earth? Oh yes, that little lovely green planet that I made. Such a gem. And then he frowns. More trouble, I suppose. Gabriel. Yes, sir. Another fight broke out. This time it's in Ireland. The landlord, with a smile. Ah, the Emerald Isle. One of the best examples of my handiwork, if I do say so myself. And the Irish. Confidentially, Gabriel, I can't help having a soft spot in my heart for the Irish. Such a warm, loving people. Gabriel. Yes, sir, they're currently being bombed, shot, burned, and clubbed. The landlord, sternly. Who risks my wrath by attacking my jolly, lovable Irish? Gabriel. As usual, sir, the Irish. The landlord thoughtfully, I think it's high time I personally intervene down there. I shall wisely adjudicate the dispute and thereby demonstrate how all men can live in peace and brotherhood. Gabriel, nervously, frankly, sir, I'd advise against that. The issues are rather difficult to, and then the landlord interrupts. Are you doubting my omnipotence, Gabriel? Just tick off the facts and I'll hand down my verdict. Now, just why are the Irish beating and killing each other? Gabriel. Well, basically, sir, to determine which are the better Christians. The landlord. I beg your pardon, Gabriel? Gabriel. Yes, sir. The Protestant majority has been persecuting the Catholic minority for years in Northern Ireland because the Catholics burn candles, eat wafers, and drink wine in church. The landlord. Well, that's settled. Obviously, those who would persecute their fellow men for such piddling reasons have no concept of what Christianity is all about. I will declare the Catholics the true Christians and have done with it. Gabriel. Yes, sir. Does that apply to the Catholic majorities in Spain, South America, and elsewhere who've been persecuting Protestant minorities for years because they don't burn candles, eat wafers, and drink wine in church? The landlord. Good me. No. Is that all they can do? Persecute each other? Gabriel. Oh, no, sir. They also persecute the Jews, Muslims, Hindus, and Buddhists. The landlord, sadly. Are there no true Christians down there, Gabriel? Gabriel. Well, the Jews have been so busy being persecuted over the centuries, they haven't had much time to persecute anyone else. But if you want to declare them the true Christians, you'd better hurry, sir. Now that they have a Jewish state and an Arab minority. Perhaps, sir, it would be safer to declare that true Christians are always in the minority, whatever minority it might be. Sir, are you listening? The landlord. And add a phantasmagoria of rainbows, one Milky Way, eight octaves of birdsong, and the scene closes there. Albert Camus, in The Rebel, and if you read the book, then there are certain things that ought to stand out, but among them, at least for me, the one thing that stands out is, don't rebel if you don't know what you're rebelling against. And here I'm reminded this morning of a tree, and I'm reminded of all different types of people who look at the tree. It's got some rotting branches and things on it. And I think that there is one group who would say, destroy the tree because it's no good. There's another group that would say, leave it alone, don't touch it. It'll make it on its own. And then there's another group that would say, well, go out, buy some pruning shears and some of that stuff that you put on them to heal the wounds once you've created the wounds by clipping off dead branches and some of the live branches. Take time with it, and we think that we might be able to restore life to the tree, and it's possible that it can bear fruit again. Now, some of us are not content to leave the tree alone, and some of us are not content with the total destruction of the tree. Some of us are more concerned about pruning and caring the way any competent and knowledgeable gardener would be. This does not lessen the pain, however. There is almost as much pain, at least if that thingamajig that they've come up with now that says that plants can feel, there is as much pain in the whole pruning process, perhaps even more, because it's so diverse and so widespread than cutting it down. Certainly more pain than leaving it alone. So often, our theology has had a way of being informed by our sociology. Our contention is that the reverse ought to be true. Our sociology, our every being, ought to be informed by our theology, and that's what I want to talk a little bit about this morning. Again, these are some notes from my own little thing called Not So Random Thoughts from the Black Condition. The church must be liberated from religious bondage. Churchmen must get themselves together and decide who they are. Churchmen here does not limit itself to clergy. They must ask whether or not they are servant of people or agents of white institutional Christianity. The church has an opportunity to become a school of ethics, raising questions on how, why, and responsibility. But this does not mean that it should follow the style of traditional Christianity. Law must be reemphasized as secondary to love, for love is the fulfillment of the law, rather than the perversion, and this is the common perversion today, which sees law as the fulfillment of love. But it's not simply the concept of love which must be liberated in this country and in this society, in the world for that matter. The same is true of the concept of justice. The new emphasis must be on justice, and it must be a justice of distribution rather than the justice of retribution. Some of us want to get past the justice of retribution. Distributive justice emphasizes equality of opportunity, while retributive justice emphasizes equality of punishment. One is concerned with retribution, the other is concerned with rehabilitation. It seems to me that a sane society and a sane church and a sound theology must be more concerned with rehabilitation than with retribution. The final challenge which confronts the contemporary prophets of our time, and the ones in our midst, has to do with the survival not only of the black church and of black religion, but of the church itself. We are presently inundated with jet age circuit riders, white and black, who for an honorarium travel from church gathering to church gathering, telling people about the irrelevance of the church, the obsolescence of the local congregational model, and that separate denominations are anachronisms, etc., 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 etc. While some of these critics are simply getting maximum mileage out of their thing, their rather superficial criticism, some of us would claim that we don't fit into that particular category. While I feel that the Lutheran Church has certain conspiratorial things about it, one of them is to wear out my rear end on a TWA jet, I still don't see myself as one of the jet age circuit riders who talks about the irrelevance of certain church models without at least attempting to put something in its place. However, the thing that I try to inject into my thing is so often misunderstood, and I understand why, because that's how Jesus comes across to most folks, you know. And this is the person whom I would like to replace some of our congregational models. There's no doubt that the church, along with the society, will be forced to change its basic structure if it is to remain relevant and if it is to survive. Form will follow function. As the function of the church changes, so its form must change. Now, I like to talk about Abraham and Moses and all the rest of the people from the Old Testament, Jeremiah, Amos, and others, because I think that they have a message now to us. As their style changed, as their context changed, the fact that foreign lands called for different styles of engagement from life, for example, for Abraham along the riverside in Ur of Chaldees, and for Moses in Egypt, for Amos in Tekoa, south of where he came to preach his one sermon. The church then in the contemporary world must see its function as both engagement and abandonment. Engagement refers to the role for which most seminary students are trained, the priestly ministry, counseling, providing for worship, and on all of the other things for which seminarians are trained. But it also involves the function of teaching and making theology relevant to the process of change. Implied in this concept is also the idea of leading rather than following along in the revolutionary parade. The function described as abandonment has two meanings. In the first place, it may mean a literal vacating of the premise, abandoning a building for more effective utilization by schools or other community functions. Abandonment implies leaving the self-righteous sanctuaries where men gather to escape the realities of life, I've talked a little bit about this earlier, and going out into the midst of life, bars and supermarkets and what have you. By now, some of you know where I spend some of my time, and I think that more folks ought to be out there. When I was in jail in Alabama, I remember my district president asking me how I felt and whether or not I had any special revelations when I got out of jail. I said, yeah, every Lutheran pastor ought to spend at least 1 month out of the year in jail. For the right reasons, of course. Some ought to be locked up for other right reasons, too. but we won't deal with that now. Abandonment also means freedom from excessive preoccupation with maintaining the institution. Whether an institutional thing lives or dies is secondary to whether it is a servant structure meeting man at the deepest level of his needs, his dreams, and his concerns, provided those dreams are the dreams which I tried to describe in an earlier lecture. What will emerge out of the ferment of the present will undoubtedly appear to be radically new, for it will represent what Archie Hargraves, who is a black preacher and who teaches at the Urban Training Center in Chicago, what he calls a blackened theology and a reversal of the concept that the institutional church as we know it today is no more than a floating crap game. The church as a floating crap game, dice that is an interesting concept, and I wish I had time to develop that, but we ain't got time, so we'll move on. What will emerge then out of the ferment of the present will undoubtedly take on this radically new appearance. It is no surprise, therefore, that black theology is rediscovering the Old Testament, and it is also rediscovering Jesus. If this sounds like a large agenda, it is. But then those of us who look at the agenda always remember our prototypes, Abraham, Moses, Amos, Jeremiah, Jesus. And we look for things which have foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Are we going to be discouraged? You bet we are. Are we going to want to sell out? You bet we are. Are we going to fail? You bet we are. Our hopes going to grow dim? You bet they are. Because sometimes despair, and in our own despair, we wish again for the warmth of what we have now come to recognize as tombs, the warmth of the institution which says nice general things on solemn occasions without becoming, if you will, cynosures of the crowd and without crawling, as one man described, into a building called Koinonia, but at certain times takes on the appearance of a lion's den. But we can hardly expect us to do anything other than that. And we won't turn back, I promise you. And we are asking that those of you who are committed and those of you who are perched on the verge of commitment understand the beauty and the rhythm of that sort of lifestyle. Now, this by no means is an attempt to glorify, develop a rationale, or to justify my own personal style, but it's a style which did not come from me. It comes from God and from His Son, Jesus Christ, and it comes, for those of you who saw it, through men like Dietrich Bonhoeffer and many other saints who have, in a very, very real way, proven unequivocally that it can be done. So the concern of the man of God is not so much a concern about one kind of dream or one man's dream, but also a concern about other men's failures and how you add substance to their dreams. Discontent becomes despair without faith in something bigger than ourselves. Dreams turn too easily into nightmares and disillusionment without the power of truth and without the power of grace behind them. What I'm saying is, in essence, religious faith provides a perspective on meaning. The symbolic cross of the Christian faith reminds us that out of apparent defeat can come victory, and out of apparent evil can come good. This is a lesson that must be central to the church. This is the lesson that is central to black theology and to those of us who are described as innovative or, in your words, black militants. Describe us as you will. That's the thing that we hold on to. And it's the prize that is ours. The empty cross, the other side of Easter, the other side of Pentecost even, the other side of, if you will, the conventional irrelevancy, general irrelevancy of church as we know it today. So the call is to a new adventure. And it's forever before me. I hope it's put before you. I would be negligent again if I did not caution you that before you lead your churches or your community into the streets of revolution, you must meet Camus' definition of a rebel as one who knows on behalf of what he is rebelling altogether as much as against what he is rebelling. That's it. Now, I think I may have left enough time for us to chat a little bit about anything you want to chat about or about some things that I may have said here. Well, I've often said that the how, especially as it relates itself to the mind of Christ, you know, the mind which did not think that equality with God was something to snatch at, but made himself of no reputation and identified with oppressed people. You know, the mind of Christ it's a groovy thing, but you know, it could get people killed. You know, we have no study guides from any publishing house that I've seen, you know, which has even started to touch on what I've suggested. I do, however, say that checking out with your master every day through a study of his word, and I think that Harv's study this morning was like a giveaway of, what is that? Yeah, that's a fancy one. But, pardon me. Harv's study this morning, you know, was like the kind of study I dig. Oli's devoting this morning was the kind of devoting that I understand now. So you do check out with your master through a study of his word and through prayer what your marching orders ought to be. But then don't try and escape it once you get them. You see, that's our problem. We'll write commentaries and... we'll write commentaries and doctrinal treatises. One of the fathers of our church, Francis Pieper, some of you have heard of him, you know, has a four-volume dogmatic thing, you know, that it takes 40 years, 10 years for each volume, to erase, you know, because it somehow trapped us, and we read that more than we read the Bible, you know. Around when I was in the seminary, we used to have a joke, you know, hey, did you read your Book of Concord before breakfast this morning? You know, we are much more inclined, Book of Concord, you know, the Augsburg Confession, the Apology to the Same, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Every morning before breakfast, you know, those are what your marching orders are, as opposed to a simple study of the word and prayer. That's as far as I can take you. But if you do that, then you're turned on. And I don't see how you can avoid being turned on.
Well, your word justice interested me. You know, I think of the figure of justice up on the court building, and she's always blind, or blindfolded. I think if I were to have to petition someone who held a club over me, economically, socially, whatever, I think rather than justice, I'd ask for mercy. I think I'd come off better.
Go ahead. I want to press that one further, Gene. When all sorts of trilogies have been written about the lady. You know, there are two ladies in this country that poets, you know, have written about. That lady, and the lady who stands, you know, at the gateway to the eastern part of the United States. She's called the Statue of Liberty. You know, the lady with the torch, you know, standing in the harbor. Somehow they've lost their meaning. You know, and, quite frankly, there are some black poets who want to take the blindfold off, you know. Because that's the state of affairs now, you know. She can't see and we won't let her. Of course, the symbol of the blindfold was something else, you know. The fact that she, you know, she did not see color. You know, she did not see class. You know, she did not see, you know, the differences among people, and she did not administrate her justice that way, you know. But not so in this country. If you're poor and you get in trouble with the law, you are in trouble. If you're rich and you get in trouble with the law, then it wasn't trouble. It was an exercise in, you know, it was an exercise to determine, you know, how well your money works.
Legal gymnastics.
Yes, legal gymnastics, I think it would be called, yes. Maybe some lawyer could help me a little bit on that.
Hey, Will, would the term justice be related to people of equal values, whereas mercy might, I see mercy as being asking from someone of another value, you know, of another worth or something higher, you know, I'm asking mercy, and to ask mercy, I think, of a black man or of anyone who is, at this point, who is oppressed, is...
Yeah, well, I can't really speak to the mercy part too much, Gene. You know, I think that black people are merciful. I know they're merciful. They're more than merciful. They're stupid.
But I was thinking, you know, if we went to the black man and asked for justice in our treatment of him, we wouldn't have a leg to stand on. The only thing we can ask for is mercy.
Well, mercy, if you mean by mercy forgiveness, you are forgiven. You know, But forgiveness is a person. You know, forgiveness is not some weird abstraction, you know, some vapor that, you know, that you can't quite get your hands on. Right, Ole? Ouch.
Well, maybe you could say something about the cry now, whether it's from the white community to the blacks or the students or whatever, is go through the proper channels, work through the established channels. Maybe you could say something about your feelings.
I think that the proper channels, as we see it, is like stretching an electric wire along the length of Lake Chelan and yet coming within that much of making final contact. That's what channels mean to us now. You know, channels are things you dial on TV sets and radios, you know, and you never quite get them in as clear as you want to get them in. You ever notice that? That's why you've got contrast and tint and you know, you've got all sorts of doodads with which to finagle if you want the channel to come in clear, but then you're never quite satisfied. My wife always gets after me, you know, because I'm listening to two ball games, Oakland A's, San Francisco Giants, and trying to watch a television program at the same time. The medium is the massage. You know, that's a little book. Has something to say about that, you know. And then he sort of points up in the book about how we, and there is in McLuhan's medium is the message thing. You know, he has this centerfold of a guy trucking down a highway, and then there's this rearview mirror. Did any of you see this? The rearview mirror. And in the rearview mirror, there's a stagecoach, you know. And McLuhan pitches this, you know, as driving into the future backwards. You know, backing into the future. We're always looking through things, you know, through the rearview mirror. And that's channels for us, you see. That's channels. Terribly confusing. We have got a channel that's pretty clear on issues of justice, on issues of reparation, if you will, or what have you. That channel, and he allows himself to be that, is Jesus. You know, and watching and studying and observing to the extent that you live that style means that you short circuit a lot of the so-called channels in this society. You just cut through them. They are not there so far as you are concerned. Of course, we are always at this point terribly cognizant of the fact that there are people who don't see it that way. Well, you know, then the civil rights song, move over, or we'll move on over you, is rather apropos at this point. That's not the way we want it to be, but that's the way it has to be if freedom and if justice is to become a reality, which may never come in my lifetime. I live with that every day. And for that, I'm terribly sorrowful. But then I've got little children whom I hope will not have to say, I ain't gonna live through what my old man lived through. I'm gonna have justice, or I'll die first. Before I be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free. Or the epitaph on Martin's grave, free at last, thank God Almighty I'm free at last. And maybe real freedom and real justice comes when the kingdom comes. I suspect that that's when it happens. But then that still doesn't give us the right to wring our hands and not to try and pluck some out of the viciousness of the circle and the viciousness of the system. And that's what the preacher and that's what the Christian ought to be all about. He spends his whole life short-circuiting things.
Really?
Yes.
It seems like even in some discussion, maybe you've dealt with this in some other lunch that I've attended, but the impression of the black by the white and certain other things, no system or something, that, you know, maybe trying to find freedom here isn't maybe the ultimate approach. I mean, there's the oppression of white of the white, and I'm sure there's the oppression of the black of the black. And it's, you know, I don't think that the oppression of the black by the white is the only, maybe the real issue, is it?
No, it's not. It's not the real issue, Werner. But it's the only symptom that we can get our hands on right now. You understand what I'm saying? For example, one would use the example of the whole Nigerian Biafran conflict, blacks oppressing blacks. But however, when you chase this thing, this conflict, back to its logical beginning, it somehow starts with missionaries and mercenaries, you see. And it starts over the question of oil and other things, so that even the Nigerians and the Biafrans are fighting each other for survival. Survival in what? Well, it's a survival in a thing, a vicious thing, which is pretty much presented in Shell signs and Standard Oil signs and other signs, you see. If one looks at the whole Vietnam thing, it's not merely, you know, an ideological posture which brings about the conflict, but it has something to do with money, you know. It has something to do with perverted views and understanding of what justice is, you see. And usually people are able to buy their way into situations like this and kill people in the process. But you're right, you know, I don't want to leave anybody flat, you know, that the issue is just an issue of black and white. I did deal, you know, a little bit with this in earlier lectures when I talked about the oppressed community. It's not necessarily relegated to black people. And here I use blackness not, you know, not as skin color, but as a state of the mind, a state of the condition that people find themselves in if one accepts the fact that blackness means inferiority, nothingness, sin, and night, you know, and all of the other frightening things about blackness. I know I feel an affinity for the Beverly Hillbillies, as I indicated later. You know, people laugh at them, you know, just have a ball watching them. But folks in Appalachia don't. You see, they don't, because that's oppressive, and that's presenting a view of a culture and of a people who are poor, you know, and who are being robbed blind by U.S. Steel and others with strip mining, you know, and destroying, if you will, you know, the beauty of the land, the fact that we can sit on steel chairs, you know, and there are folks in Appalachia right now who got to crawl into the hillside to find coal enough to keep warm, while there are stacks and stacks and stacks of it at railroad dumps and things like this, you see. I understand that. It's not just an issue of black and white. Women, you know, the young, the innovative, you know, Holden. You know, I mean, you know, I don't want to embarrass y'all, you know, but the very fact that you have got to succumb, you know, to a PR thing is frightening to me, you see. For me, it's perfectly obvious why this place should be, you know. I have no problem seeing that. What meaneth all this PR? You know, all the beautiful, you know, the funny calendars and drawings, and you know, and the things that you've got to spend money on, that you could spend money on, you know, you could spend that money doing something, you know, other than developing PR. Yeah, right. This is why, you know,
I think overall, our, you know, it is a frightening experience, because where do you start? If you're just going to deal with the symptoms, well, you're just hitting the, you know, top level, and there's, you know, there seems to be no chance at all of ever, you know, making an improvement.
Part of our problem is recognizing, pardon me one second, Al, okay? Part of our problem is recognizing the cause behind the effect when we see it or when we're told about it. The Kerner Report, for example, at least in one little sentence, said that white racism is the cause behind the effect. You know, it's not a black problem, yellow problem, red problem. You know, it's white racism. Now there's panic in the land. There's mass guilt feelings and all sorts of things. However, the Kerner Report does not deal with the cause. It identifies it, but it doesn't do one thing at all to deal with it. It goes on to describe what's wrong with black people and red people and yellow people and other things, as opposed to trying to dissect, if you will, subject to evaluative analysis, white racism. What is this white racism thing, you see? So Del Book makes a mint off of it, and nobody's the wiser, you see. I agree, you see, but there is another cause for white racism. But here it's a progression stage downward, you see. We can get it back as far as Adam and Eve. Well, that's where the church comes in. Adam and Eve, whoever they were, you know. I'm not concerned about... I am concerned about sin, you know, while I don't talk about it too much, because I think that sin, too, is, you know, that's a cop-out. To say, well, we're all sinful, you know, and that's why we are the way we are. You know, that's a cop-out. And that's, you know, that's a denial, if you will, of the incarnation. maybe Ludwig is going to talk a little bit about that. He ain't. but I think that he has something to say about the incarnation, which I think may speak to a little bit to what your concerns are at this point.
Well, you've come in quite slightly now on the Kerner Report in a critical way. And I'd like to push this just a little to be sure that I understand you, because I don't see in the Kerner Report what you see. I saw the charge that the problem is white racism very clearly, and I saw a pretty effective documentation of the effects of this racism in terms of what happens in our society in the police department when racist attitudes are accepted as the order of the day. And I saw a pretty effective detailing of the kind of conditions that people have been living under in many parts of our country. And surely a study of some of these white racist attitudes, for example, in the suburbs that aren't in the newspapers very much these days, might be very appropriate, might be very effective. But it seemed to me that the real burden of the Kerner Report and the real responsibility of the Kerner Report was to try to figure out what had happened and what the situation was in the cities. I guess what I'm saying is either I don't understand the Kerner Report or I don't share your criticism of it.
I don't think you understand it.
Well,
or you would share my criticism of it. That's about as simple as I can make it. There were people who did understand it. Johnson understood it. That's why it took him so long to make comments about it. And as soon as he made his comment, he had already started another commission. Remember, the commission was the Eisenhower one. You know, and he put on there the old philosopher. The waterfront philosopher, Eric Hoffa, a man whom I respected and loved until he got to Washington and started oppressing black people, you see. So this commission replaced the Kerner Commission. And it was supposed to refute, if you will, the charge that white racism was the primary cause behind our problems in the cities. You see, it was designed to do that. However, it couldn't. It couldn't, even with Eric Hoffa on there, it couldn't. The one thing that comes through quite clear to me is that it even moved to identify another problem, the problem of the police. Well, see, black folks know full well that police are not the engineers of this society. White folks have sort of left it up to the police and to the military to engineer, you know. But they're getting orders from somewhere else, and it's somewhere beyond the Pentagon, too. You know, it's way, way beyond the Pentagon. It's way, way beyond some 9 families readily identifiable in this country, DuPont and others. It's way, way past that. It's even beyond Strom Thurmond. However, you know, that's where it starts to get identified a little, you know, a little more with, you know, with a good senator from South Carolina, you see. Police, you know, well, I said, you know, somebody said, the pigs are coming. And I said, why don't y'all stop calling them pigs? Maybe you ought to call them piglets, you see, because they are not the real pigs. Any more than the Ku Klux Klan was, you know, is the real invisible empire. They, you know, they were highly visible. But there was a motive force behind them, which was, to a certain extent, invisible, or at least not seen. Not invisible, but not seen, and not dealt with. The Kerner report refused to go that route, basically because it would have become quite offensive to those who have the houses hidden in the wildernesses, you know, and on lonely beach shores and what have you. You see, that's where the problem is. So I say, if you read that, you'll see that the Kerner report stops with white racism, and it deals with other symptoms of that sickness in talking about police brutality and stuff like this. But the police, while they were described as the social engineers of the society, are not. And any person in his right mind would know that the police are not, or ought not to be, the social engineers of this society.
Well, in my work, I am...
Al had something,
oh.
Bill. Could...
Oh, that was a long time ago.
Yeah, I know it was, but do you remember what it was?
Well, it was in connection with the idea of sin. Warner was mentioning the idea of the emphasis on black versus white and whether or not that's, you know, where the emphasis should be. And it seems to me when I was in high school and early college, all the time I heard people say, you're a sinner, you know, from the pulpit especially. And after a while, I just accepted it, you know, I'm a sinner, and that was nice, and everybody else, like you were saying, you know, it's a cop-out. And not until I was confronted with very real and very practical, concrete ways that I was a sinner, did I begin to really accept that. And to me, one of the most concrete examples was the idea that I'm a racist.
Yeah.
And learning all the implications that has, and that takes in an awful lot. You know?
Yeah. I use the contrast here between asphaltized and concrete, you know. Saying that man is sinful, you know, is an asphalt concept, asphaltized concept, but not entirely concrete. That's, so I agree with you. Okay, Bill.
Oh, I was going to say, when we started talking about, when you mentioned engineers behind the police department and so forth and right racism, I think I can shed a little light on that. In my work, I travel a lot and I meet people in all different towns and buyers in these different stores and so forth. And I had an experience about 2 years ago that I never forgot. I went to DeKalb, Illinois. It's just a little bitty town, about 20,000. Oh, it's less than that, 15. And they had a new buyer in my little department store there, a nice little old lady. She was 50 years old and wasn't even 55, I don't know. But I would say the average, on the surface, an average gal that looked very pleasant, very nice. So I said, well, how'd you happen to get here? Well, we had lived up in Madison, Wisconsin, and I started having problems up there, racial problems, and my husband and I decided we'd get out with our little girl. We wanted to go someplace where there was no problem. So we came down here to DeKalb. There are she didn't say black people, but there are no black people around here.
What'd she say, Bill?
Well, she said niggers and everything else,
okay.
And colored. And she said, well, we got ourselves a little farm here about 5 miles out of town, and we're ready. I said, what do you mean you're ready? And then this little old lady just really scared it to come out of me. She says, we've got rifles and we've got machine guns and we've got that little old farmhouse full of ammunition. And she says, one of these days when the time comes, we're going to shoot them all. This is the engineer we're talking about behind the police force, that silent voice, you know. And we have in the last few sessions I've been here, we've had a few people, different nights and so forth, say, what can we do? You know, what can we do concrete? Well, I think that we really don't have to go out and do something. We are where it is right now, wherever we are. What we have to do is talk to these nice little ladies that we live next door to, and these people that we have lunch with, or people we ride the bus with, or people we play golf with. And we've just got to somehow, I don't know if it can be done, like you say, maybe it can't be done, but we have to try to make them see it the way you have explained it, made us see it this week. And this is the only thing we can do. We can't all of a sudden switch our role, say I'm a salesman now. I can't all of a sudden become a someone that goes down and builds buildings in the slums or something. That's out of character for me. But I meet these little old ladies every day, you know, or someone like them, and this gal I have lunch with, this gal I have coffee with, this gal, at the risk of maybe losing an order here and there, I'm going to have to talk to. And she may want to shoot me too, I don't know. But I never forgot this gal. I actually said, we've got a machine gun in our house. And my goodness, I couldn't believe it.
Do you think that's enough for us to do?
No, I don't think it's enough, but I can see it'd be a full-time job just for me, because I meet these people.
Well, you see, you start
12
doing
hours a day or 14 hours a day.
You start
to have this panic to do something. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you see, what can I do again is a cop-out. He's not asking what he can do. He's just making a not so simple statement about what he's got to do, which is a part of becoming what he is. You know, he obviously somebody's going to recognize him for what he is, and they're going to start telling him what he's not. Watch it, you're not a salesman. At least you ain't going to sell to me. but that's that's one of the prices that one pays when he starts to deal with fear. I wish I had more time to talk about fear. And the little scripture passage, perfect love casts out fear. Helen presents it so beautifully in most of the songs that I've heard. However, the reverse is also true. One of the few passages in the Bible that you can turn around and it means just the opposite. Perfect fear casts out love. And I know what he's described is true. There are even bazookas in some of the fashionable suburban communities. And I remember talking to a group of ladies one night who had just come in from the firing range. And they still had their hardware with them. And I said, you ladies are so frightened that if your husband happens to come home from the office 10 minutes early, or if the milkman should have his truck break down and he delivers the milk off schedule, you'll kill your husband and kill the milkman. You'll kill anything that doesn't fit into your particular schema, because that's what fear does. You see, that's what fear does. And I know that this is true. Black folks ain't gonna come into those suburban communities. They know better. They know better. The last time it happened was when Martin King marched into Cicero, and he ain't going to go out there anymore. Well, obviously Martin ain't. Those who follow him ain't going to go either, you see. Because now we're starting to see how paralyzed we become by fear, and how much we lean on gunfire, and, you know, and how secure we feel when we've wrapped our sweaty little palms around a thing that's made out of cold blue steel. That is one of the engineers, yes. Fear, one of the grand architects of the situation that we've got now in this country. So thanks for pointing that out, Bill. I've been wanting to ask you this all week, and I'm not even sure whether you have an answer or even thought about it, but how are you going to relate now when you get back to the cold world to white people?
See,
I'm not going back to a cold world. There are a lot of people who talk about the cold world as opposed to holding. I think Jean is one of the exponents of that phrase. I ain't gonna pick on her, you know. But I like to identify people because that's, you know, it helps you to understand a little bit of what's behind it. Maybe Jean is justified in seeing it as a cold world because she's going to a sorority house. That's about as cold as you can get. But it's not a cold world. It just isn't. And I'll relate to white people in the same way I've related to them before I came to Holden. In contrast to many people who talk about having had a Holden experience, this has not been a Holden experience for me, you see. It has been an experience, but it has not been a Holden experience because at least when I talk, Holden is not removed from the cold, cold world, you see. I don't think. If the other were true, then I've been terribly derelict, you know, in my duties here. It's a very warm world. And it's a world where Christ is present. I celebrate going back home, just as I celebrate coming here. There are reasons for celebrating. I celebrate the jagged edges of buildings going up and coming down and the staccato-like sound of sledgehammers and air hammers and other things as much as I celebrate the natural state of things here. Once I get past the litter bag stand, you know, out here on the hard trail. So, you know, my relating doesn't change. I have learned an awful lot here at Holden. I've learned an awful lot. I have gotten to know people that I probably would never have known had I not been here. I'm carting off a lot of loot. Beautiful, beautiful loot, man. The Terry Saturns, Freds, and Avises, and Al's, and, you know, I mean, Jeans, and Al's. And, you know, I'm surrounded by, well, you know, you just don't express, you know, you can't express that sort of thing. Well, that's not, you know, that's not so much a Holden experience as it is an encounter and an experience with people, you know, and there are people out there, more people out there than there are here. So this sort of increases, you know, the contact ratio, you see. So I'm happy to be going back. If tears are shed, then they are tears of joy. To be getting back, to be going back.
Could I ask a question about mood as over against this whole problem of...
Could you put a comma right there? Werner, is Werner still here? Okay, I don't have a watch, but somebody knows what time Werner plans...
Right,
somebody knows what time Werner plans to leave, so blow the whistle for me. I don't have to pack anything. My good wife.
11 o'clock.
Huh?
11 o'clock.
Okay, Harv. Well, just give me 30 minutes, you know, before Werner leaves. Okay?
Okay.
And well, we'll go until, you know, you stop us. Okay. I'm sorry, but go right ahead.
You mentioned Camus and the rebel, and seems to me that always when you bring up Camus, you bring in a mood of gloom. Hopelessness, some real insight, but a fall of hopelessness. And I wondered if this, you wanted to carry along with your image that you used of the rebel. Is this the way you feel? And is this common feeling?
Well, there's a mood of gloom. There's a mood of sadness, but not hopelessness. The difference between Camus and myself would probably be the same sort of differences that would be expressed in the difference between Zorba and Camus. You know, And I think that Zorba is my answer to Camus, if you will. Real joy is laughing with those who laugh and crying with those who cry. Camus is a philosopher, and he is a prophet, and he uncovers things. And when the prophet does that, they ain't exactly laughing. Some folks could say, and I'm sure you're familiar with this, the same thing about the weeping prophet, or Amos, or any of the other prophets, you see. But in their prophesying, even though there was gloomy rhetoric, shouting and screaming, associated with it, as I do, I talk awful loud, and I shout, and I know that, sometimes to be heard, and all the time to be heard. But then there is, an end to all of that. Harvey Cox, for example, in The Secular City, those of you who've not read that ought to read it too, comes across pretty much the same way, And the whole technopolis, the megalopolis, these are reasons for gloom, and a pensive mood ad infinitum. But we don't stop there. Those of us who understand and who are possessed by the spirit of the wandering Jew, Jesus, understand that this is not true. You ever see Jesus smiling? You ever see him pictured smiling? Even in them pictures that Ole showed this morning. Even while he's healing people and after he sees the result of his marvelous work, he's never pictured as smiling. Well, you may have missed some of my talk. I think you did miss that part where I did a little takeoff on Elton Trueblood's humor of Christ, the fact that Jesus told jokes and he put people on, and sure he smiled. I know he's going to have a smile on his face at judgment, as he did when he was announcing his resurrection to people. And as he did probably in his ascent.
Don't you think there is a real danger, because the present problem that we talk so much about opens up such a big vista of everybody's racism, everybody's sinfulness, that there is the danger of our feeling almost totally overwhelmed with a problem, and a fall of gloom over us.
That's true.
I wonder, if that isn't the essence of part of the church's problem, in that we're still living in Monday, Thursday, and Good Friday instead of in the resurrection. Because we live in the I am guilty, and we act on the I am a sinner instead of living in the I am forgiven and acting on that. Being forgiven and living as such carries an awful lot of responsibility, an awful lot more than saying I'm a sinner, therefore I can't.
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
Thanks, Eva. Yeah.
Willie, don't you get a feeling of hopelessness when you read Nietzsche?
No. Nietzsche and Altizer's are. Altizer's explanation of what Nietzsche said, is sort of, I get a chuckle, and sort of sorensifying. God is dead. The God whom white Western Christianity has created is gone. It's the death knell for the Antichrist and the death knell for the anti-God. So, I think it's really great, that these men had the guts to say he's dead. I know most preachers, in horror, mounted their pulpit in defense of God after Altizer's thing, as if God needed their defense. it said something about their God. I never preached a God is alive sermon. I mean, you know, what do I need to do that for? Luther had the same problem. I said one night, that's why he was always throwing inkwells at the devil, you know, and stuff. I can't groove with that sort of thing. And anybody who comes out of the oppressed condition, you know, it's like when we get, you know, when we get up, how many feet are we below the lake? I forget how many feet, but, you know, I can look back and I can see the tailings. And then I'm always reminded, you know, four times I've been reminded of Martin King's words, you know. We ain't where we ought to be, and we ain't where we're gonna be, but thank God we ain't where we was. Well, I ain't where I was. And I know that there's a cosmic force somewhere. Somehow I ain't gonna spend time trying to name it. God, you know, I ain't gonna try and, you know, I ain't gonna spend all that time doing that, but I know it's there, and I celebrate that. But I know that there is another kind that's dead or dying. The little quote in Time magazine, God is dead, and Jesus Christ is his only begotten son.
Well, you answered that problem one time. You said that in Christ Jesus, that we're all. This is the whole topic. We're each individual.
Yeah, you talk about progress. You know, I think that one sign of progress is that I'm able to sit here and talk with y'all. There were times when I couldn't. There were times when I just couldn't do that.
Well, there were times when a white man in the north couldn't talk to a white man in the south. And maybe still exist.
Well, yeah, it's a damn Yankee syndrome. One little lady in Boykin, Alabama, wrote in her diary, I don't know what's wrong with the damn Yankees. My slaves were happy and free and singing, and now they don't even do that anymore. Now we're tempted to go to Africa and find some apes and have them pick our cotton and arrange for us to sit under magnolia blossoms and sip mint juleps and so forth. But then we're kind of scared to do that, because if we hadn't got some apes, the damn Yankees would probably be trying to emancipate them too. But that's a damn Yankee syndrome. We don't see any difference between North and South. The sequel to Lay My Burden Down, that's a film called Lay My Burden Down. Those of you who are dealing with cinema in the village may try and get that. Lay My Burden Down is the name of it, from the educational network. And then the second part of that is Losing Just the Same, you know, from Selma to Oakland, California. No difference. You know, so we don't know what y'all fight each other about, North and South, you know. Because North and South, you know, the man is still operating pretty much the same. We figured that it's a ruse, some sort of veiled style which keeps us off guard. We have discovered that California, for example, my family and I, we were born in Alabama, we've discovered that California is as much the land of free white people and brave black people as Alabama was. A little more honest, that's right. A little more honest, that's the way we see it. The subtlety of racism is a thing that we have extreme difficulty getting at, you know. But you are correct. About the damn Yankee syndrome, but not about white folks being good in the North as opposed to, you know, white folks being good in the South. Can't see behind me. If somebody wants to emote, go right ahead.
At breakfast this morning, the topic was brought up about prophets in present time. We can think of figures like Martin Luther King and other people that have confronted us with the big issues and problems of the day. See, some of the discussions that we've had in the last few days brought up the name of Eldridge Cleaver. I think we'd have to consider a prophet of our time from the quotations that you've used, even though among many, many circles he's considered very unpopular, people trying to belittle him because of the charges that have been brought against him. We won't try and get into that, whether these charges are just or not. But I think, and I'd like to hear some opinions on this, I believe, we should listen to him. Regardless of whether the charges that are brought against him are true or not, that yet he has a message to deliver. It's very important, and the things he brings up should be dealt with.
Yeah, you know, I think that one of the crimes in our society, and it's a crisis of the intellectual, is that as intellectual as they are, they still, you know, insist on reading about people as opposed to reading them. And just one simple statement to your statement here. Don't read about Eldridge. Read Eldridge. And if you read him, then you'll start to understand. Read Eldridge.
Person I'd like to meet is Beverly Axelrod.
That was Eldridge's lawyer. Quite a girl.
She must be.
She's quite a woman. She's just so beautiful. And so is Charles Gary, who follows in the tradition of Beverly Axelrod. Beverly Axelrod is the white lady lawyer to whom Eldridge dedicated his book, Soul on Ice. And he was in love with her, and still is. But she's not accepted in the social cliques and the social circles readily identifiable with white womanhood. That may be what makes her so beautiful. It's a manuscript that I have, Ken. It's about 340 pages of typewritten material that I have gathered over the years, starting with my ministry in Alabama, and some of you will now be included. That may be why it'll never get published. There are a couple of publishers after it now. They want to do something with it, but I keep resisting for several reasons this publish or perish thing, which obviously plagues any of us who have been granted the grace to think. So it's my own little manuscript, and I share bits and pieces. It's a way of not having to sit down and, you know, and go through the whole business of preparing lectures. You know, you understand that. You know, you've got your own unpublished thoughts. You know, so these are my unpublished thoughts that I make public, but I insist on being around when they're made public. You see, because not everybody honors copyright thing. You know, it may go to print. In a year's time, depending on whether or not I can see in there freedom for me to change my mind about certain things that I might have said. One of the peculiar hang-ups that those of us who can write have, and Martin always had that, Martin King always had that hang-up, is that where do we go from here? Chaos or community is a long, long way from stride toward freedom. You know, because where do we go from here as a part of the stride, you know, which indicates a clear progression sort of thing. His last one, the one that Coretta edited, called Trumpet of Conscience, his lectures over the Canadian broadcasting system, are even more potent than where do we go from here. So some of us have problems with committing things to print and becoming a part of a library shelf because of that. Now, I'm not trying to pour cold water on the writers, because it's these people who create a climate for me to move. But I somehow have this fear, if you will, you know, of not being able to change my mind once I've committed myself, you see. Then too, I'm quite lazy. You know, I have not yet been able to, that's only secondary or third or whatever. I've not been able to discipline myself to going to some dark, dank, quiet place like Bimini. That's not so dark and dank, really, to write. But maybe when I get off the streets. Then too, some of the personalities to which I refer time and time again in my speaking, I don't want them to read about themselves either, because I think that to a certain extent this creates a credibility thing. I remember when Jim Cohn's book, Black Power and Black Theology, came out, a Panther brother of mine picked it up in an airport, and his first reaction to Black Power and Black Theology was, oh my God, here's another black preacher who's going to capitalize on the style, on the lifestyle, and he's going to write a book and make a men out of it. Well, I'm trying as much as I can to avoid that, because not everybody understands why you commit them to print or why you commit them to the cinema, even. Don Stewart, night minister in San Francisco, says the same thing. This new filming technique called cinema verde, you know, where you get the sound and the picture, and you know, and this is the way documentaries are developed now. The night ministry, there was a television special on that, and it almost destroyed Don's ministry, because his parishioners could not understand why he allowed that thing to become public. You see, why he betrayed some of the thoughts given to him without being, you know, without having them around to check out whether or not it ought to be done. So folks who have influenced me and ideas that I have received, it takes a long time to check out all of those people to see whether they would allow themselves, even though they are made anonymous, you know. I'm not Jacqueline Suzanne. Those of you who don't know Jacqueline Suzanne, she was a hit with her little treatise on pills, and now she's got a thing out called The Love Machine, the life and legend of the all-American boy, Robin Stone, The Love Machine. And she's catching hell now, you know, because some of the literary critics of our day ain't exactly buying her. And that's why when she's on talk shows and things like this, she's almost always on the defensive. And this lovely, yeah, right, this lovely woman, you know, is quite vicious, because she feels now that she has got to protect her interests. And some of us don't want to become guilty of that. So, well, I'm sorry for the lengthy answer, Ken. It's a manuscript, and it's called Not So Random Thoughts from the Black Condition. Not So Random. Well, I find myself going back as far as the introduction and changing things. I've been doing that for almost a year and a half now.
Will, on this business of losing your province.
Yeah, why don't you speak to that, Harv?
I don't want this to be taken too literally, but I guess my point is that a prophet can't be listened to. We listen to Jeremiah, Therefore, for us, he isn't a prophet. We can hear that in the church every day, and because God is dead for us, it doesn't speak to our minds, but we can hear it. We can listen to him. And I don't think a man becomes a prophet, even if he's living by his day, unless we tell him to shut up. I want to tell Will to shut up. Well, the difference is that he keeps talking. I can tell Jeremiah to shut up, and I can shut the book. But a man isn't a prophet until I have to tell him to shut up, because it's offensive to me. And unless I say that, then he isn't coming through, nor is the gospel, because that's offensive. So a prophet to me, no man can be labeled as a prophet, except through the person that is telling him to shut up. Only a person, I mean, what I'm saying is a person can be a prophet, whether it's Eldridge or whatever, can't be labeled as a prophet only by the person unto whom he is a prophet, once he tells him to be quiet, to shut up. And I say, don't take that too literally. Obviously, we're still listening, but I want to say, well, will you please shut up?
Yeah.
He's a prophet, but he's still talking.
Yeah, and one of the things that you learn real fast is that prophets don't call themselves prophets either. Being a prophet is not something that you work at. You know, I'm going to become a prophet. It just doesn't come that way. Becoming what you are always means prophetic posture. I mean, that's true of anybody, even my little children and your little children. It's a style which emanates from the heart of God. Thanks, Harv. I think that you put your finger on it. Yes. Yeah, the words pagan and savage and heathen, you know, are words which have been used to define people whom I believe and have come to know are not pagan and savage and heathen. But the pagans and the savages and the heathens are those who are calling people pagans and savages and heathen. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to trot too much of this out, because then we raise more questions than we've got time to answer. But I think that if any of you look at it, we are a society that's quite pagan. However, we're always shifting the blame and the definition. We are quite pagan, quite heathen.
I have this to ask then.
And the church too has opted for that paganism.
Do you mean by this partly then not assuming responsibility for that which we are quite responsible for?
That's one form of it, yes. Right.
I have this to ask then, if we are a pagan society. As I'm somewhat inclined to agree with Billy Graham, that what it means is that we cannot legislate love in this country. That will never be like legislative. Congress may be able to pass laws concerning civil rights, but is not what is needed perhaps is a great repentance. The Pentecostals will call it a revival. So on the part of our Christian people, on the part of our country, in turning to God so that this love may be a true love toward others rather than just an artificial love, we may change our attitude on the outside artificially. And people may write books everywhere imploring us to change our attitude toward each other and the needy. But I believe what is needed more than ever then is the preaching of forgiveness and that God forgives, and that we need a gigantic revival here in our country. We call ourselves a Christian nation. And how this is about to come about, would it not start in the church first? It went amongst the Christians who and go out and send this message that this is what is needed, even in our cold churches, everywhere.
Cold churches. And I think that Jesus would say, amen to that, Wes. For now, judgment starts at the house of God, you know. And the so-called houses of God are certainly not sacrosanct. And they are certainly not free from the condemnation of the Christ, who recognizes the prostitution of everything that he was, built into the bureaucracies and the systems which we have fashioned. I'm glad you said that. But, you know, I still think that we ought to understand that turning to God is a physical and mental impossibility. We can't turn directly to God. We turn to visible manifestations of God and of the Christ, people. And I think that the Holden hug, if you will, is one of the visible topographies of that. A lot of us may be inclined to turn to God, but how do we turn to him? You know, I mean, how do we turn to him unless we embrace his humanity? We can't do it any other way. You bet the country needs revival, and it needs repentance. And certainly if repentance is repentance, then forgiveness is a reality, you see.
I wonder if this portion of scripture would kind of summarize that. Is it our reason?
Certainly.
This is Ephesians, I think it's 3, starting with 14 verses, to the love of Christ. For this reason, then, I fall on my knees before the Father, from whom every family in heaven on earth receives its true name. I ask God from the wealth of his glory to give you power through his Spirit to be strong in your inner self, and that Christ will make his home in your heart through faith. I pray that you may have roots and foundations in love, and that you, together with all God's people, may have the power to understand how broad and how long and how high and how deep is God's love. Yes, you may come to know his love, although it can never be fully known, and so to be completely filled with the perfect fullness of God. To him who is able to do so much more than we can ever ask for or even think of, by means of the power working in us, to God be the glory in the church and in Jesus Christ for all time and forevermore. Amen.
Thank you.
Well, I think we'll tell you literally this time to shut up. Knowing full well that you'll be shouting up here.